Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Over the last 20 years, our politics has become more polarized and more partisan. But today, this polarization feels more intense, more personal, and more intractable than ever. Here in Washington, it's not easy being a moderate.
We've seen one heck of a lot of paralysis in government.
There are so many other issues where we could make a difference and help bridge the partisan divide that so often ends in gridlock.
Can't you just get along? We like to see you work together.
But I think a lot of independents need to know that they can invest their vote in the Democratic Party in 2020 if we appeal to the middle of the road.
There's ideological rigidity on both sides.
What I've said that we need are fanatical moderates.
We've never seen anything like this before.
And throughout the country, moderate voters are feeling the same.
This is Mark from Beaverton, Oregon, and I consider myself a moderate Democrat. I prefer establishing consensus in society, but the folly of only one party being accommodating is becoming painfully clear.
My name is Karen Bryant, and I live in Gaylord, Michigan. I am a Democrat and consider my views as politically moderate, but I feel the younger Democrats on the rise are far too left. They're more like socialists.
This is Ellen from Skipack, Pennsylvania, and yes, I consider myself a moderate. I feel both the Democratic and Republican parties are moving too far to their respective lefts and rights, and neither party captures my full interest.
Bob from Brooklyn, New York. I'm a moderate Democrat. I feel completely left out of the political dialogue. The Democrats are not addressing affordable health care, and they're putting their priorities on identity politics.
Hi, my name's Tiffany, and I'm from Lexington, South Carolina. I grew up my entire life being a Republican, and it's really hard because all of a sudden you find you don't have a home.
I'm Amy Walter, and today on The Takeaway, we're asking, what's a moderate to do? My first guest is a man who finds himself boxed out of a party he once ran. From 2009 to 2011, Michael Steele was head of the Republican National Committee. Before that, he served as lieutenant governor of Maryland, not exactly a deep red state. And today, he's a contributor to MSNBC, where he's often criticizing the president.
I'm a conservative. It's hard as it is to believe, I am very much a conservative, a very strong proponent of the Second Amendment and gun rights, even though I don't own a weapon. That's the libertarian side of my nature, and very pro-life. Just to go through the box, checks the box that most conservatives oftentimes check. Certainly on the economic stuff, I've been apoplectic about the level of debt and spending that Republicans have engaged in over the last 20 years or so. I identify as a Lincoln Republican. I believe first and foremost about and in the founding principles of the party, which was all about the individual.
Today, Steele says the party's heading in a different direction. In his words, it's virtually unidentifiable.
You can be a Republican and not a conservative, and you can be a conservative and not a Republican. And in this space, we kind of equate the two, and yet they really aren't the same thing. And conservatism is what you may be inside the Republican Party. Republican is what you are outside of conservatism. You know, it depends. That's always, for me, been a strength. That has long since sort of gone the way of the dodo inside the GOP, and we've gotten into these roiling battles over identity. And that was something that Trump took advantage of, quite honestly. A guy who had no roots in the party, who even on a good day pretended to be what he wasn't in terms of conservative versus Republican, and yet was able to, I think, scratch open some of those wounds and pour a little vinegar in there and get things roiled up to the point that we now find the party virtually unidentifiable compared to where it was.
So how do you then define the term moderate Republican? And is it different today to be a moderate Republican than it was 10 years ago, well, 5 years ago, a year
that's
ago?
That's a great question, because a moderate Republican today is a Reagan conservative 25, 30 years ago.
If somebody defines you and says, well, that guy, that Michael Steele guy, he's a moderate. I see him on MSNBC. Okay, so you don't find yourself in that category.
No, I don't. But the circle has gotten so crazy and come around so much that conservatism is viewed, what I would call traditional conservatism, is now viewed as a moderate. The key thing about conservatism and the Republican Party, just taking those two tracks and linking them, is at the end of the day, the party was always about, again, the individual. So we didn't stand in the way of immigration. We weren't about building walls. We were about assimilation. We were the party that argued for assimilation. We were not anti-science and anti-environmentalists, but we, in fact, created the space for environmentalism to take a hold because of our fear that certain forces and powers and interests in the country would overshadow and consume that environment to the detriment of the people. Which is why Teddy Roosevelt, last time I checked, card-carrying Republican, advocated the way he did and created the safe space, to use that term, for our natural environment. So when I look at that, and don't even get me started on civil rights, for heaven's sakes, you know, as we sit here with the Voting Rights Act sitting in the desk drawer of the speaker, we were the party that advocated and pushed those agendas. And that was a conservative thing to do because it conserved the rights of the people.
So when did that change? When did that become known as being a mushy, moderate, somebody who was less conservative, and that conservatism is defined as being opposed to all of those things?
When we adopted levels of extremism that were founded in fear, founded in racism, founded in anti-intellectualism. Look, I don't pretend to be the smartest guy in any room I'm in. I'm just a guy in a room who's at least learned enough through books and common sense to have a conversation. All right. And that was something that was okay. Today, that's a threat for some reason to
people.
When
did that start, you
know,
do you think?
That's, you know, I think there were a number of cultural things that began to occur where people, in looking around at themselves and their communities, some people felt, well, how did he get ahead of me in line? And why are all these other people here that I don't know who don't look like me, sound like, who are these people? People began to forget that America was not a white nation. Actually, America was a place of color before the white man showed up, lest we not understand and appreciate our history. So they look around, and I listen to white nationalists now talking about taking their country back. I'm like, well, are we going to take it back? You need to give it to Native Americans because not even you belong here. And it's, again, this lack of intellectual appreciation. You know, I'm not saying you've got to be smart and learn it in encyclopedic knowledge, but you do have to have an understanding and appreciation of how this great nation was formed and why it was formed, and appreciate sometimes the ugliness of that formation and not lose sight of that. And I think a lot of people have, and it has become, Donald Trump is a perfect reflection of this era. It's all about me. I'm under threat. You're thinking bad about me. I disagree with you because I don't like you, not because you're wrong on the facts or the points of law or whatever. So you've saw this, I think you've seen this sort of slow degradation, this slow clawing back to an era that quite honestly didn't exist. When I hear people at Trump rallies talk about, you know, we want to go back to a better time, we want to go back to a different America, I'm like, what America do you exactly have in mind?
Well, don't you know the America they think they
of course
they have
I
in
do.
Mind?
They have this idealized view of the 1950s.
That's right.
I mean, the 50s were great. I was born in the 50s. It was a great time, right? But when I was growing up, my mom couldn't take me to certain places here in Washington, D.C., where we lived, and I grew up here in the city. When I went to high school, it was a big deal that whites and blacks in the 1970s were in a classroom together. And this is what, 20 years after Brown versus Board of Education, and people are still having an issue. We had a huge busing fiasco in Prince George's County, where I now live today, back in 1973, where residents had to sue to integrate the schools. So, you know, exactly what time are you talking about that was great? And I would say even for white folks, it wasn't that great. Just talk to the people who live in Appalachia, you know, and lived in parts of the South. So we have this idealized version, this leave it to beaver notion of what it is to be white in America, which isn't even realistic for white folks. So
where does this, I get asked this question a lot in audiences from people who raise their hand and they say, I feel like I don't know where I belong politically. I agree with some parts of Democrat, Republican agenda, but I kind of consider myself a moderate. I don't have a home because neither party seems to want me. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think it is true. I think it's very true. And I think in the main, most people, I think the country is largely a center-right country. It is centrist on most social issues, which is why we've seen a lot of people interpret it as this sort of progressive liberal lurch to the left. No, it is basically the way Americans come to a point where they go, okay, I get all the pieces and this works. We're in a good space on marriage, gay marriage, for example, or on other hot topics. Even something as profoundly frustrating and tension-filled as abortion, the country has largely settled. And so to the great wisdom of our founding fathers and mothers, because you know when those gentlemen went back home, there was a woman saying, so what'd you do today? Nah, we're not doing that. No, I don't think that makes a lot of sense. So we know how this narrative plays out. But in the great wisdom of that, this idea of self-governance was ultimately left up to us. And people find comfort in that, where they can, at the local level, decide on these big issues, as we've seen. So I think people find themselves in this sort of center-right space. And the right portion, the more conservative approach, is when it comes to things like money and spending and taxes. They don't want the government to be overly aggressive and take more than it absolutely needs or should be allowed. They don't want to saddle future generations with debt and a lack of access to prosperity. So there is that. You can then make also the case it's center left for the same reasons. If you want to go, well, okay, on those social issues, we tend to be a little bit more left leaning. So the country pretty much is in that center space already.
So why isn't Washington there?
Because the parties have polarized it. The parties have gerrymandered themselves into a space where it's tribalism works. You know, Amy and Michael live in a neighborhood. We're comfortable in that. That's why we're in that neighborhood. So our expectation is that neighborhood is going to reflect our values, how that neighborhood is perceived, how it communicates. We're all good with that. And we feed that. We help create that. If someone moves into this neighborhood that sort of throws things off kilter, a little bit disruptive, the hair on the back of our neck stands up. We become a little bit defensive. We become reactive. And we see that. We used to talk about it in PTA meetings, you know. Now it's grown outside of the confines of something like that into a broader environment in which it is very tribal. It is very much about me, mine, ours, here in this corner. I don't care what you do over in your corner, but in this corner, this is what we do. And the strength of this country has always been about the connectedness of communities, not the isolation of communities, which is why even in some of our more turbulent immigration periods in the turn of the last century, for example, where certain communities were forced into, quote, ghettos, over time, you were still able to make that connection to the broader American society and do that wonderful thing called assimilation. No one stood in the way of that, which is why it worked. Today, people stand in the way of that assimilation, whether it's assimilation through immigration, assimilation through education, assimilation through wealth creation, assimilation through cultural changes. We don't want to assimilate because I like my tribe the way it is. And that, I think, has undermined one of the core values of this country, which made it that shining light on that hill for all to see.
So how do we get to a place where, if we are a country that is, as you said, center-right, center-left, that's where most people feel the most comfortable, are you at all optimistic that we can have a political system that reflects that?
Yes, two things. One, the moment the American people realize the three most important words in our founding documents were "we, the people." It is the linchpin, the key, the cornerstone to everything else that follows.
But isn't that what got us to where we are now? My definition of "we, the people" might be different from your definition of "we, the people."
It may be on the edges, but it can't be at the core, because at the core, it is about us. Out of many, one. It's about us, all right? Us, U.S., us, community. And so the moment we understand that we are empowered by this ideal of "we, the people," we get to decide. There is no federal government unless we allow it to exist. The second point, the moment we decide we're done with that, that's when it changes. And the way you change it is at the ballot box. You get out and you vote. I know this firsthand. We changed the focus and the nature of our political landscape in 2010. We went out and did the very thing. We made the case to the American people, which is why I called it Fire Pelosi. And I used it not just as, oh, gee, getting, you know, Nancy Pelosi out of the speakership, but it became a euphemism for government. She became the symbol of government. And the question is, if you're tired of what government is doing, change it.
So here's what's happened, Michael. This is what I've noticed over these past years that I've been in Washington. Whenever you have elections like 2010
right.
or 2006, the victims, the people who lose in those years, are the very people who want to try to bridge the gaps. They're the so-called moderates. Mm-hmm. In 2006, it was Republicans who lived in the Northeast. Now they're no longer there. They were wiped out right. in that wave election when Democrats won. In 2010, your party wiped out all the Southern moderate Democrats. And so what we're left with is each party wins an election, but when you win, you lose the very people in the middle who can help to bridge the divide between
the
really
two parties. Do you really think you lose them? Where'd they
go? I'll give you a great example. Mm-hmm. In 2010, you picked up the seat held by John Spratt in mm-hmm. South Carolina, mm-hmm. replaced by Mick Mulvaney.
Mm-hmm.
That is not somebody who's particularly interested in bipartisanship, would you say?
Fair point. But that's not how he ran then. That's how he is governing or acting now. And that's the problem.
Okay, so you're saying we could have replaced moderate Democrats with moderate Republicans.
Right. Okay, so let me give you an example, Amy. Every 4 years, I don't know how strong I can get my language here.
You can do whatever you want.
So every 4 years, Republicans bitch about what? Oh, guess who we just nominated? They bitched about Bob Dole. They bitched about Mitt Romney. They bitched about John McCain, right? Do you think the only people voting in a Republican primary are the hard right conservatives? Where are all those other folks? So if you sit on your ass and let the outcome become self-fulfilling, that's on you. That's on you. Same on the left. Everybody's whining about progressive. You know, where are traditional Democrats? Well, traditional Democrats are where they've always been. So the question is, do they turn out? Or have their political philosophies and perspectives changed to the point where they now have acceded to or agree with this more progressive movement? Or have they retrenched to the point where they're just sitting in the corner afraid of their own shadow? Politics is a blood sport. It is always a sport in which you have to engage. You cannot just sit back and expect the outcome to meet your expectations if you don't. So for my moderate friends out there, we the people, people up, man up, do your thing, get engaged. There are more of you, electorally speaking, than you have of these extreme wings.
For people who are now raising their hand and saying, gosh, I don't feel so comfortable with where the country is. I don't feel like I fit
right.
with either party.
Right.
It is, well, where were you when you were voting for these people?
Right. Well, again, I used the example that I'd love beating people upside the head with because it tells the story of the 26th campaign. Donald Trump, would you say conservatively, alienated the hell out of women, minorities? I mean, the list is long. And yet he got 10% of the black vote, 30% of the Hispanic vote. Oh, and get this, 52% of educated white women voted for him. here we are 2 years later. Everybody's got, oh my God, how did we get here? I don't understand this. Wait a minute. Somebody voted for him. And if I get 10 white women of with an educated background in the room, 5.2 out of the 10 of you voted for this brother. So you have to check what your priorities are. And you can't lament after the fact that someone else did it. A, if you in fact voted that way, and then B, you didn't vote.
So is there room then for somebody who considers themselves to be a moderate mm-hmm. in Congress?
Yes.
And can they play any bit of a role in Congress?
Yes, they can. And there are efforts underway that's coalescing and creating the space for those members through organizations like the Bipartisan Policy Center that is working with members to craft legislation that would have bipartisan support out of the gate, through No Labels, which actually has a coalition of members who have come together and now are talking about, with respect to the next Speaker of the House, that they will not vote for that individual unless they can demonstrate support from the other side as well. I think that's good. I think that's healthy, and I think that is in keeping with the tradition of the House, for example. Because again, the Speaker is a nonpartisan player in the House. He's the Speaker of the House.
Theoretically,
speaks for both sides. That's why you have a majority leader who speaks for the majority party and a minority leader who speaks for the minority. But you're absolutely right. We've moved away from that. So the play is in the House. The House is the ultimate reflection of the people because we send them there to represent us. What you're going to see, I think, is over the next 4 to 6 years is a recycling that will occur as lines get redrawn. And, you know, I look at my own state of Maryland, where when I was state party chairman, 2 years before I became lieutenant governor, our congressional delegation in a very liberal state like Maryland was 4-4, four Republicans, four Democrats. Today, it's 7-1. Seven Democrats to one Republican. And on, you know, we talk about on the right, but on the left, they drew those lines deliberately to disenfranchise those voters who would support a center-right candidate.
Right. So redrawing districts, having nonpartisan line drawing could help revive the moderate.
I applaud the thought and 100% behind it. There is no room for that center to emerge. So looking at that with the kinds of community-based commissions and structures that allow citizens to decide how the lines are drawn, along with the smart people who actually do line drawing, as opposed to the politicians who have a self-interest, to me, is how we begin to pull ourselves out of this morass.
That's Michael Steele, former head of the RNC.